You try and find Carl, he might be around. You gotta give me some volume. You gotta give me some volume.
Jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.
We're live.
Well, North Bank Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell, Jimmy on the board. SP Futures up 13. NASDAQ Futures up 70. Interesting day or interesting week this week with the market really down heavy on Tuesday morning and came down back on Tuesday, and then the Google got the, you're a monopolist, but we're not going to do anything about it. Ruling, which people take to, Jimmy, I think it's interesting that, really bright people that somehow, I'm not saying anybody should do this, that's not been in the business of maybe either trading on a trading floor or doing something dumb like doing a podcast. Although I love doing a podcast, it's not always obvious the difference between what is said and what the message is. And it's a combination of body language, it's a combination of something. And you never really get the subtleties of human communication are there. And you can't just read the tape. I mean, I'll give the best example for most people who I'm sure weren't alive. I don't know if they're even available on radio or on TV, probably somewhere. If you look at the Kennedy-Nixon debates, and if you watch it on TV, virtually everybody said that Kennedy kicked his ass. If you listen to it on radio, virtually everybody said Nixon did a better job. So there's some combination of body language, appearance, eye contact, something that delivers the message that some people pick up and others don't, or people pick them up differently. I mean, the Powell news conference to me was somewhat of a capitulation to, you know, Trump beating him on the head. This thing with Google, it may seem like next to nothing, but the market took it as, okay, these big firms, they got the license to fly here. And it's been kind of coming for a while. I mean, the only real issue you get with antitrust with one of them is out of Europe. Once in a great while, you get a minor slap on the wrist. But by and large, they've been monopolists since day one, and nothing has stopped it. To the point where you look at the valuations, and I have a lot of clients that have these stocks. You look at the valuations and you go, why would anybody own this stuff? And then the other side of the coin is you look at it and go, God, they're the only game in town. I mean, they seem to have anything they want from government they can get. And no rules apply to them, nothing like that. So it makes it very difficult to value that stuff. I mean, you look at even an Apple and you say, well, boy, it looks like their cachet, their growth, they're in areas that they don't have anywhere near their new areas don't have anywhere near the markup, for lack of a better term, or margin, that their old areas, you know, they're pushing. It's very hard for them at their size, even though they make a boatload of money, it's hard for them at their size to double, yet they're kind of valued like a firm that's going to double. But I wouldn't necessarily bet against them either, because there's a whole new variable in here, which is or what do you think, which is up government ass variable or something, that somehow or another we're sort of picking winners here. And yesterday I sent out to a bunch of the people on the show, you know, we were arguing yesterday regarding the steel thing. And I was, you know, talking with Kevin about it a little bit and Russell. And there's six or seven steel companies here. Most people can't even name them. I had to look them up. Now, what does 10% of the government owns in U.S. Steel, which, you know, Trump says he alone can determine whether they can move, whether, I mean, he's not going to sit in the boardroom, but I wouldn't put it past him. What does that mean, you know, as somebody who is investing people's money and trying to do the best job I can? I don't need any more variables, to be honest. You know how many variables there are in trading to start with. Now, I'm going to sit there, and I know we don't trade a lot in steel companies, and we got a couple people that have some of them, but what does that mean going forward if somebody asks me, should I buy U.S. steel stock, which would now be what, whoever that bought them, should I buy U.S. steel stock, or should I buy Nucor, or should I buy Cleveland Cliffs, or should I buy somebody like that? I don't know. Does that mean the Cleveland Cliffs place down in Indiana is not going to get a contract because it's going to go to U.S. Steel? I mean, I don't know. What do you think?
That's a good question. I mean, I like the idea that you brought up the Kennedy debate, because one time in college we did do both. You had a videotape of the debate.
Why don't you kick your voice up just to hear?
We had a videotape of the debate. And then the professor turned it off and played the tape. And you're right, you have two different views on it. And in regards to Google, it seems that AI, the people are using AI more to find out as a search than going to Google. And Google was able to use that. But you are correct. I mean, it is a kowtow situation that if you kowtow to the administration that possibly, you know, things will go your way. You won't get slapped. You know, you move on. And it is interesting. And you're right. I can't name the number of steel companies anymore because there are so few, and I don't think, do we have any U.S. steel companies?
Well, yeah, there's quite a few, actually. Cleveland Cliffs.
Okay. I know Acer Middleton bought out U.S. Steel, or was that Nippon?
Yeah, Nippon, I think.
Nippon bought them out, you know, and there was a big deal on that. So we'll see. That's why I kind of played Prince this morning, because this is how the market is. Let's go crazy.
Well, yeah, but you don't, you know, you get another... we'll just put U.S. steel companies in. I sent this out to. I thought I sent it out to you yesterday as well as the other people, but maybe I didn't. Of course, you know what the funny thing about this AI is. This is a snide remark. I find myself falling into the same habit as everybody else. I mean. Used to be when you look for like the list of the amount of steel companies in the world, you'd kick it up and then you'd say okay, you'd go down to Wikipedia or go to some other place. But now, even I find myself being a lazy ass and just whatever AI overview comes up. I bet this is gonna kind of kill Wikipedia because it's much much more detail. But the main ones here are Nucor. They're the largest steel producers, a major player. Cleveland Cliffs, they bought Inland or Bethlehem, one of the two. Steel Dynamics, commercial metals company. They do a lot of the rehab or the recycling. There's Nippon. They just bought U.S. Steel. You know, and then there's ArcelorMittal. There's Carpenter Technology Corporation. I mean, there's a bunch around. But if you just read the news, it's all U.S. Steel, right? And you know, it's just a odd thing. The reason why I was I'm zeroing this way, boy, to me, everybody knows, listen to me all the time, and everything values on everything else. I'll take, for instance, this came out today, CNBC's official NFL team valuations. for 2025. Here's how the franchises stack up. The average franchise is now worth $7.65 billion. That figure marks an 18% jump from last year. I know, how do these numbers not necessarily match up? Dallas Cowboys, they got number one, $12.5 billion. Now, of course, some of these places include the stadium, some don't. I mean, they're all a little different in that regard. Cowboys also point the highest revenue at $1.27 billion. So they're trading 10 times revenue. Not trading, but valued allegedly. In 2024, they generated $300 million in sponsorship revenue, by far the most in the NFL. Rams are second at $10.7 billion. But here's the average team revenue during the season was $687 million, up 7.3% from the previous year. Right now, if you're an analyst like I am, a financial analyst, first thing that should pop into your mind here, Jimmy, is, okay, how exactly did the valuation go up 18% when the revenue went up 7%?
Good question, and we do have Mr. Flanagan on the line.
John, how are you?
I'm good, Tom. Jim, how about you?
It turns out Lou is in the air. Hopefully he's in a plane. He's in a plane, we hope, but he's in the air somewhere. We're talking about team valuations, and we were talking about when you give messages to people, what you can read and when you listen to them, and we talked a little bit about the Kennedy-Nixon debate, and what the deal was that Nixon didn't think it was any big deal. So the guy had a Fred Flintstone beard, and he didn't shave again in the afternoon, and he came right from some other event, and he refused to wear makeup. Where Kennedy saw it was a big deal, took a nap, of course who knows what else he did when he was in bed, that guy, was all shaved, looked good, and if you watch TV,
he was tanned too.
He was a clear, he wore makeup, and Nixon refused to wear makeup. You know where that debate was held? Jimmy, you probably
it was up in Clark Court, the WBBM studios.
Over by, behind the Hancock Center over there, that was a studio.
Yeah, it was here in Chicago, yes.
What's that now?
I think the building was torn down some years ago. It had been, it's a very unusual looking building.
Yeah, it looked like a studio building. You could drive the car right in.
Like a two-story thing. In fact, the other night, WTTW aired the American Experience. It was a two-episode story on Nixon. I think it was from 1990. And I remember seeing it when it came out, and I hadn't seen it since. But it was kind of a refreshing change from the Ken Burns, routine, which they all start to blend together after a while, whether it's baseball or jazz or Civil War, they all start to sound and look alike. But this one was different, and I thought it was pretty fair to Nixon, and there was a whole sequence there about the debate.
Well, the odd part of that is Nixon and Kennedy were pretty good friends.
Yeah.
They both...
They were freshman senators together at the same time, and they kind of, JFK gave money to Nixon's campaign, it says in this documentary, so $1,000 or something, which in 1948 or so, that's pretty good money.
Well, there was some kind of a shindig, whatever that means, in Ohio, where they wanted a debate of two young senators, and the Democratic Party thought JFK was their up-and-comer, so they sent him, and the Republican Party thought Nixon was their up-and-comer, so they sent him. So the two of them did a public debate with questions and stuff somewhere in Ohio. And this is back in the days when, most people took the train. So on the way back to New York, they shared a sleeper compartment. Can you imagine that today?
No. Not unless there was a scandal lurking in the wings.
Oh, yeah, I know. Because the only funny thing that during the campaign that Kennedy said about Nixon was something about there was a big cranberry juice or cranberry problem. It was something was getting into the cranberries with salmonella or something. And evidently it was only the Washington cranberries and not the Wisconsin cranberries. Something weird like this, Janet. And it was kind of a national thing. And at the time, it was probably the single biggest reason why all your vegetables and stuff started to get labeled or where they were from. so they could identify if there was ever a problem. Now it's gone on and on and on, and Kevin knows a lot about that. And now it's even better with the, you know, not the AI, but the cloud and all the other stuff. But blockchain, I think they use blockchain stuff for this. But even in those days, well, evidently, Kennedy went to Wisconsin, and somehow Nixon had a big glass of cranberry juice in Wisconsin, and so did Kennedy, and, you know, to say that Wisconsin stuff was good. And Kennedy said something like, well, if this stuff kills me, at least I'll have the something about I'll have the satisfaction of taking the vice president with me, or something along those lines. I'm sitting there going, the guy had the world's best humor, and or driest humor. But no, they were pretty. And Kennedy said, if I wasn't running, I'd vote for Nixon. You know, different world, eh? I mean, it doesn't have to be like this. It really doesn't. Anyway, we're talking about this football valuations, and when I read these articles, and I can just tell somebody's mind does not work like mine. First of all, John, they've got the valuations up 18%, but the revenue up 7%. Now, even as a lawyer sort of dude, you're going to scratch your head on that one, right? So they've got the average team is worth 7 point something. It's $8 billion. Now, they also, the average revenue, well, the television and licensing now is $433 million per team, up from $403 last year. So that's 8% or so, 7.9, what they're talking about. The earnings also climbed 7.9% to $137 million. All right, so if you take the average team is worth 8, and they're making $137 million, that's quite a PE, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
So if you buy a team at $8 billion and you get a loan, let's say 6%. Of course, we'd be getting our credit card. By the way, you have an $8 billion tap on your credit card. I don't, but say we
no,
did.
I don't.
So say we're paying 6%. Well, if we're paying 10%, that's $800 million a year, right? So 6% is going to be like $500 million a year in interest. How the hell do you buy something for $8 billion? If you're only making $137 billion, if the cost of carry is $500 million. When, I don't know if you listened to any yesterday at all, Kevin and I and the two, Dr. Ademiak and Russell, the two professors, were trying to figure out or explain the difference in people's view of the world going forward. And you see it, younger people, like Dr. Ademiak was talking about how in her classes, when you ask these kids, even though they're all in college or in Purdue, they're going to a really good place, none of them feels that they're going to have enough money through their life. They have the house, the two cars like their parents did. And they just think there's no way that, even though the government can say your inflation is 2%, they all know it's a bunch of crap. They're not convinced that any salary that they make anywhere along the line is going to keep up with inflation. And we talked about the St. Louis Cardinals going from a 30,000 season ticket load, was it 3 years ago or something, Jimmy, and to 18,000 now.
Yes, and, yes, we did.
And now we're seeing these guys thinking the world is the oyster of the NFL, which it currently is. I mean, I think, but how far can that go? I mean, how much can you really make on gambling if people... salaries don't go up. You're going to gamble your entire salary away. You're not going to pay your rent. I mean, what are you doing? What's your view? I'll stop talking. What's your view on all this, Jenner? There's different views of the world. Now, right now, the NFL is the cast ass, right? I mean, 72 of the 100 most watched telecasts in 2024 were football games. Media rights deals now generate an average of $12.4 billion annually. How much further can that go if people don't have any dough?
Well, I'll defer to you. As the analyst, Tom, when it comes to evaluating any sports team, but you know, take the NFL as an example, maybe the most extreme example. Normally, I mean, there is as far as I know, there's a calculation for the market price, meaning what it's like having a comparable in the real estate market. What is this thing worth to a purchaser? What role does goodwill, which, you know, forms a part of a business valuation usually, what does that play with a sports team when we're dealing with something the size of any NFL franchise? And what kind of market is there really? I mean, this is about as closed a circle of buyers as I can think of. It isn't like there's any competition that's open, you know, that you can get a conglomerate together or a hedge fund or something else and buy it, as what happens in, like, in the case of Walgreens or something. So where is their market, and what's different about this kind of valuation from what goes into a normal business?
So you're starting to sound like a economics professor.
My one economics professor at Notre Dame would be shocked to hear that.
Well, I mean, what you're going to put on the blackboard and say, okay, somebody's going to raise his hand and say, wait a minute, it's a monopoly, essentially, or a cartel. We'll call it a cartel. So you're going to put on the blackboard, one, cartel. Now, whenever we were told to value stuff or write something about an industry in any of the classes at the University of Chicago, the grad classes, they'd always say, assume free market, assume cartel, assume monopoly. Because the answers are all different, right?
Right.
I mean, not totally different, but somewhat different. Right, so you just brought up number one. Okay, now we're starting from the spot that if we plunk down our $8 billion, we're $400 million in a hole year one. All right, so whatever their view is, which we'll try and, after break, we'll try and figure this out. Whatever their view is, it's not the normal purchaser. I mean, if you bought a building at a price where the first year you lose 75% of what you just paid in interest, I'm going to say in your world, the building world, that's kind of a bad investment. Yeah. Wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, but now when we come back, let's talk again. What is so different about this? And is it the same as baseball maybe used to be and maybe still is in some areas? Are they over their shorts or over their skis or over a puddle? We don't know. S&P futures up 10, NASDAQ futures up 49. But this finds its way into investing and stocks as well. So it applies, believe me. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now.
We're back.
Hello and welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Jimmy on the board. S&P futures up 10. NASDAQ futures up 50. Dow futures up 23. CRM is down 19 bucks. They had earnings last night. That's 7.5%, 737. 237 is where it's trading. And Salesforce, they had the earnings, and they came out and said they're not, their forecast was pretty crummy going forward, but we'll see how that works out. But right now, they're down. A lot of their earnings lately have been down this last week. Over in Europe, DAX up 178.6%. FTSE up 18.2, Kekaran down 7, call that flat. We're in Asia. Nikkei up 641, it's 1.5%. Hang Seng down 284, 1.1%. Shanghai down 47, 1.2%. Those guys have been up, so it's a turn for those dudes. Bonds down 1 basis point, 4.20. The Bund down 2 basis points, 4.71. We have oil up down 74 cents, 63.23. They've been just locked in this 63 number, plus or minus a couple of bucks. But our buddy Rick Pappas says there's still some trade there because heating oil, the crack spread has been going wild. Heating oil has been going up higher than RBOB, and they've been flying around there because I guess we export the diesel and the heating oil. We don't so much on gas. Brent down 70 cents, 66.90. Natural gas up 4 cents, 3.10. Gold, which has been on a tear, not so much today, down 39 bucks, 35.96, still high. Silver down 61 cents, but still 41.08. Those are high. We have the FX, foreign exchange, 116 on the euro, which is pretty much where it was. The pound, 134, was over 135, so the pound's a little lower. And we have Bitcoin down 1,000 bucks, 110.971. Jimmy, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports, Cubs suck.
Yes, on the sports, Cubs did lose to the Braves last night, 6-1. The Diamondbacks did beat the Rangers, as well as the White Sox beat the Rangers 2-0. The White Sox beat the Twins 4-3. In weather, we have 49 degrees with a high of 60 with plenty of sunshine in Chicago. And tonight it is clear with a low of 60. Now in Phoenix, it is 74 degrees with a high of 98. Thunderstorms with possible flash flood warnings. In regards to traffic, let's take a look. We're having some computer issues here. The website is giving us no information except on the Eisenhower. So the inbound Eisenhower from Wolf to the Jane Brown interchange is 29 minutes. Outbound is 20 also, is 29 minutes. Outbound is 20. The Dan Ryan, the inbound expressway is from the Jane Ryan, is also not really reporting. So the only one that we're showing is the Eisenhower.
Well, we were just on the Kennedy, and it was packed, so I'd turn back if I were you.
Yes, I would turn back, but the Travel Midwest is having some difficulty because it's giving us NA on a lot of them, or maybe it just doesn't know.
What about AI?
We'll have to ask AI. We'll have to ask. But back to you, back to the show.
So John, I'm looking as...
interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised
hold
of...
Hold on.
This self-directed trading is a moment.
For those that maybe don't remember this, but you know, Jan's the oldest among us. Remember when the Pro Bowl on Saturday would get better ratings when the NFL on Sunday?
Yes, I do.
And the by far
boxing too. I think
boxing by far, yeah. And now you know, I'm not at all predicting the decline of the NFL. Matter of fact, it looks to me like they're doing pretty good. But I just as a person, I would look at a stock that's up 25% with their revenue up 5%. The same way I look at this, you know, can you? How do you value stuff? Eventually, you know, if it's a six flat, and you've got, you know, a guy who knows how to handle six flats, first thing he's going to say is, "What's your income? How much you want? What's the?" You know, what's your upkeep per year? With those three numbers, he can tell you the price, right?
Yep.
Now, when you start getting into areas where you can't necessarily do that, I mean, it was never easy. When I started the business, Jen, the Dow was 800, and interest rates in the CDs were 15.5%, and some companies were trading down to a point where the dividends had to be like 10% or nobody wanted the stock because you could get more than that in a bank, right? Without any risk. So then that was obviously a little odd because you would think that, gee, if the interest rates ever came down, they'd start shooting up. But they didn't come down for 10 years or 6 years, right? And they really didn't come down. The stock prices didn't go up a year and a half after the interest rates started to come down. So But now the NFL, to me, it looks like the seven big stocks. They're the only game in town. They're going to roll over everybody. And I think, to a certain extent, they're right. But now, how do you value it? You know, I mean, me buying an NFL team is the same decision for me if somebody said, do I sell NVIDIA today? You keep saying it's got a high valuation. But now on the blackboard for the NFL, we go, wait a minute, it's a cartel. Now for an NVIDIA, we're going to say, now, whoa, wait a minute. They seem to have a product that at least people are saying for the time being is somewhat unique, and it's going to keep growing. Then the next question would be, for how long? I mean, is somebody going to catch up, not catch up? And somebody might say, they're 5 years away from catching up, or they'll never catch up. Somebody else might say, man, I don't know, a couple of these Chinese companies and Intel we just gave money to and a couple other people, they might have stuff half as good a year from now or 2 years from now. Then you and I might have to say, with Jimmy, we go, okay, wait a minute. If somebody's got stuff half as good, how big of their sales is half as good enough for? I mean, this, what I'm trying to get to is this starts to expand almost like a rock thrown in a pond, right? I mean, once we start getting 1, 2, 3, 4 on the blackboard, now it gets pretty complicated, doesn't it?
Yeah, what about the role of branding or, you know, municipal identification as a part of valuation? By that, I mean, what's it worth to a city to keep, you know, a team that's been identified with there as opposed to, you know, not being that interested in having that team go somewhere else, and the building up of a connection with destination place takes some time. You know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work as well. But where does that fit into all of this too?
How can you figure it out? The Bears are up 39% this year at $8.9 billion. Because now why that is, how do you? I'm going to say that if you and I were to do the calculations sober, without adult beverages, without somebody telling us where they want it to come out, we're gonna probably say that a team is not really worth all that much to a city. Maybe a couple of them do. Okay, the Cubs probably are because it's a destination spot. People want to come and see Wrigley once or something. But now we never subtract the amount of times people from Chicago go see the Cubs on the road and they're spending money there and not here, do we?
No.
I have buried in my, I'll use the term files loosely, there's two or three really good studies, and they all involve Salt Lake City. I mean, people, they don't have a baseball team, right? But they evidently paid a bunch of money into the team that built the AAA facility. And I think they built a basketball arena. I don't know if it's for the Jazz or for somebody. But there's like two or three. They might have built a soccer stadium. Every single one was a clunker in terms of how much it was supposed to give the city and didn't. And every one of them had trouble paying the debt. And I think most of them didn't pay the debt. Every single one was a clunker. So it's a question of what, you know, it's kind of a close-to-home argument. Are the Cubs valuable to Chicago? Yeah. How valuable? I don't know. The Cubs will say one thing, and you and I might say another. Now, the two biggest, they used to be, not anymore, the two biggest tourist attractions in the city, which I'm sure you can name, we'll go back 10 years and name them. Actually, the Bean's probably in there now, isn't it?
Davy Pier.
It used to be the Buckingham Fountain and the Visitor's Gallery at the Board of Trade. Now, can you say for sure that somebody came to Chicago with the sole purpose of looking at that visitor's gallery and spent 3 nights here? They came to the visitor's gallery 3 days, and that's why he's here. And oh, by the way, if he is, the Board of Trade should give you a bill, right?
Yeah.
Now, but how do you prove it? How do you? And people would say, the Board of Trade doesn't get to do that, but the Cubs do. Well, the Cubs, thinking of people they bring, okay. How many people do they bring here? I mean, it's up to you to tell me. You're the one wanting the money, right?
Right. Well, it may be easier to get those numbers now because you can track you know, online ticket sales, that, you know, where the order originates. And, you know, but as far as, you know, with everything on a credit card, it's probably a lot easier. But I don't know. And certainly it was pretty hard to do in the past, you know, with like the Cardinals and the Cubs, which had some crossover in between. People would go to either place. How do you identify, or which, you know, what does that have to do with the valuation of the team, as far as which geographic center is supporting which team in greater or lesser numbers? So.
Well, plus if you, the Packers, for instance, if 80,000 people pile into Lambeau Field and buy booze there, how do you determine, because of the price of the ticket and the price of the beer there, did they go out one last night to the local bar in some town in Wisconsin near there? Do you count that or not? I mean, is it a shift of money? Is it additional money? What is it? These are very complicated issues. And if you don't take everything into account, if you did a paper for Milton Friedman, you got a big X on the top. You can't just pick out the parts you like and toss the other away. Although we seem to do that all the time, don't we?
No. Well, you know, I just a couple of days ago I was poking around, you know, the history of the Brooklyn Dodgers and New York Giants. I don't know why I was interested at that time, but you know what the loss of those teams meant to New Yorkers, and what the gain of those teams meant to California, and they had to go as a unit. I mean, they were restricted by the league.
They were voted to go.
They voted to go, but I mean, what this did to the value of the team? I mean, was it more of a brand in Brooklyn than it was in Los Angeles? What's the long term history? Now we've got, you know, 60 plus years of, you know, history of the franchise on the West Coast.
You know what, Jan? You led down a road here, Jimmy. Right, scribble this down, will you, for Monday? Because I'll go back. I did this research. You know, one of the most oddest phenomenons in sports. I don't know what caused me to do this, Jan and Jimmy, but actually it might have been somebody like you, Jan, talked about the Dodgers and the Giants leaving New York. And I went back and I got the attendance figures for virtually all baseball teams, but even the New York teams. And for some reason, after the war, you know, everybody comes back, well, as soon as you get back, wherever boat or wherever you're on, the attendance of all three teams in New York was really high. And from like 1947, 48, up to, when did they leave? 56, 57, somewhere 50, in there?
57, yeah.
For almost every year, all three teams, the attendance went down fairly precipitously every year during the 50s, even though most people think it was the golden age of baseball, right?
Well, they had great teams, too.
Yep, they had great teams, but nobody went. I mean, maybe they played day ball and people were worried. I don't know what happened. But if you look at the attendance of the Brooklyn Dodgers, and I'll have it next week, or Jimmy and I, one of us will get it. Okay. If you look at their attendance from like 48 to 57, it went down like every year. I mean, I'm going to say that. Maybe it did, but it didn't. You would expect after the war, people are doing better, the economy's growing like a weed, that those attendance figures would go up every year. They didn't. I mean, so for somebody to say, maybe there's too many teams in New York, I'll go to L.A., it's something new. You know, I'm sure if you were a Brooklyn Dodger fan, it was a, you know, stake in your heart, but the fact is, the New York baseball franchise in total was not doing too well in the 50s, even though they had some of the best players that ever played. I have no idea why that is. You know, like last night I was mentioning, we went to Tripoli with my buddy Bill and a couple of guys there. I was mentioning what we were talking about yesterday with the Cardinals, how they've gone from a 30,000 season ticket base 2 years ago or 3 years ago down to 18. And of course, you know, two know-it-alls go, ah, they got a crummier team. Wait a minute. You don't drop season tickets that you've had for 25 years because they're 500 2 years in a row. Somebody might, but it comes down to what's the health of downtown St. Louis corporations? They're the ones that buy the season tickets. How many individuals buy season tickets? Is there groups like Jimmy's where one person splits them up four ways. Are there wholesalers? It's a way more complicated product than just say the team won 90 games last year, they won 80 this year. That's why 12,000 people bailed on tickets they might have had for a generation. There's more to all these stories, I think. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to consider the role of television coverage, but that was still pretty primitive, you know, in those years compared to what it is now. But also demographics, as you know, the housing explosion after World War II, it wasn't as easy to hop on a subway and go to the Polo Grounds or Ebbets Field as it once was. You had to drive in from, you know, Long Island somewhere or wherever you'd move to get a cheaper deal on a new house somewhere. And I think that turned the trek to the ballpark into something more arduous than it had always been. And I think that affected Chicago teams too, really.
Well, how about, you know, I mean, today there was a time, and I should have quizzed Larry about it yesterday, but I did not, where, you know, and I know I get the, there's that Chief Luddite guy again. I think the fact that you don't get tickets is a problem. But when Larry's Sox tickets, when you wanted to transfer tickets, you had to go through some site and you had to pay somebody 15% in the league 20, and he couldn't list tickets for less than face value. So on a day when nobody wanted to go, he had to list his tickets at 120% of ticket price to break even. And that was probably the single biggest reason why he dumped his season tickets. So a lot of little tweaks that everybody says, you know, it's the new world. Maybe that's part of it. Maybe it's 2% of it. You couldn't get me to have season tickets anymore without tickets. I want to just be able to hand them to somebody and say, go. Now, I know that's Luddite. But the question is, when you look at this football, are they always going to be the top dog? And every year their valuation is going to go up 15% while their revenue goes up 7%. I don't know about that. What do you think?
And it's kind of like the education bubble. At some point, you know, they get so out of whack, and the product starts to become, you know, as hollow as, you know, it all, maybe always was, or after a certain point it became, people turn away from it and, you know, find something else to do. I don't know what's in the wings waiting to take over, though. I mean, soccer, maybe. I mean, soccer seems to have, you know, a lot more followers now, just in my circle of friends or relatives, than it did 10 years ago, by far. And people talk about it.
Well, I mean, that's another. I mean, I love everybody being able to play sports. I mean, my mom loved sports. She was miffed. I don't know if she'd have been any good or not, but she goes, "I can't believe that when I was in high school, I couldn't play a sport. I mean, why didn't girls get to play? They enjoy playing just as much. I mean, I have the idea that there should be, you know, girls playing ball in the playground just like guys, and there should be organized sports. Why should anybody not? I loved it. I did something every day. If I'd have been a girl, I probably would have felt the same way. Why wouldn't I? And that doesn't mean that I need to go watch girls basketball. That somehow or another I have to take 4 hours out to go watch girls lacrosse or guys lacrosse. Because you enjoy doing it doesn't mean I got to pay for it. Right? I mean, the only rational argument I ever heard from about pulling up money for one of these teams. One of my clients, they do a lot of work in nursing homes and stuff. Anyway, guys, they have a big group from Minnesota, and he said when the North Stars left, they could have spent $5 or $10 million to keep the North Stars, and they said no, which maybe I would have agreed with. But the hue and cry was so huge. Was it, Jimmy, how many years later they got another team up there? It cost them like 10 times that amount to get the other team.
Yes, they got the Wild.
Yeah, and how much cheaper would have been just to keep the North Stars, just to pay them off versus the new team? And I guess if you let the Bears go and say, screw you guys, I have no problem with that, to be honest with you. But, because, I mean, if you watch all these people gambling on football, they don't care who to... Jimmy, does anybody care who the team is?
No,
it's the parlay.
Yeah, so I mean, but if you're gonna, if the next mayor is gonna run on, you know, some kind of a platform where I'm gonna get us an NFL team back, and it costs $3 billion to get a team back, I guess it would have been smarter in some dumb way to keep the first team, right? But
yeah, unless you like throwing money away.
But I don't. I happen to think that if the Bears weren't here, nobody'd know. Nobody'd care after a while. I mean, a lot of people.
I agree, Tom. I guess that's maybe it's. You get to know a franchise too well, and the family politics, as it has happened with Chicago teams in the past, and people, either feel a part of the club or not part of the club, and even the people who are part of the club are kind of bored with it. I don't know.
Well, it comes down to some bit of fairness. Everybody says you got to give money to the Cubs, you got to give money to the Bears. Okay, now how many people do they bring in? All kinds. All right, how many is all kinds? Oh, come on, all kinds. You know what I'm talking about. I don't know what you're talking about. Put it down on a piece of paper. Now, I've said this before, and it's a little rubs the wrong way. We used to help out this seminar firm. We were never part of them or anything like that. That used to come into Chicago and give seminars on options trading. I'm going to say at least a week a month, maybe slightly more, maybe. Out of 4 months, there might have been five seminars. People came for a whole week. The class was over in the same building Jimmy's in, or 425, or used to be 440. And what we would do for everybody is we'd get a couple people from the Options Institute to talk, and we would my brother would talk about what a brokerage firm should do for you, and how do you put in orders, different kinds of orders, things like that. Nothing went, oh man, if you do this, you can make $1 zillion. We never did anything like that. And we would do a mock trading on the trading floor because, we knew a bunch of people, and that was a lot of fun. People loved it. Okay, so they would have 65 people, would stay four nights, would have 12 meals. We'd pay for two of them. And we'd buy drinks on Friday night, which was always a big tab. Okay, so we brought in whatever, 25 grand or some number that we could identify to the city once a month. I'm not saying we should have got a dime for it. I don't think the Board of Trade should have gotten money for the city every time somebody went to the visitors gallery. But the fact is, a city's like a human body. Everything's working. Everybody's contributing, right, Jen? When things are going right. And for you to say, wait a minute, I need something from you guys. So if a football team wants to land here and say, wow, I'll play football and I'll sell tickets and I'll make some money, knock yourself out. Wait a minute, do you know there's people going to come watch my game? Or you got to give me $1 billion. Wait a minute, what about us? And I have people, some have been on the show, would look me right in the face and said, you don't deserve a dime, you're not big enough. You're just a schlump firm, which, we're not a schlump firm, we're not that big of a firm. And that would always, let's put it this way, Jan, if I was a guy that would take a swing at somebody, I might have wanted to, let's put it that way.
Yeah,
no,
sure.
No, we should do that for the Cubs, but screw you guys, screw the Board of Trade. Why? If there's a benefit window and I meet the criteria, why don't I get the dough? I'm not saying I should, right? I'm just doing my part. The restaurants that are here that I take people to, they're doing their part. CBOE's doing their part.
It's a civic asset, everybody's entitled to imagine their importance to the whole picture and think, is there any kind of appreciation being shown for this? Let's see. Let's put our cards on the table.
Now, if somebody can build something that's for $5 billion and get somebody else to pay half of it, and they own it, that's the weird part. I mean, we've been criticizing Trump for if the government gives... I don't think a government should be giving firms money, okay? But if you did, taking a piece, I don't necessarily have a problem with, because if the city's going to give the Bears $2 billion, the first thing I would say if I was mayor, okay, how much stock do we get, right? I mean, if I asked the city to build PTI a building, I certainly would expect the conversation, okay, just gave you it's $100 million, what do I get, right? I mean, how do you not have that conversation? This is Chicago, after all, right?
Or at least a string attached to the team so that they don't move before the bills are paid.
Well, at least I get a vote on things. Yeah, I mean, now we're going to leave Soldier Field. The thing, they thought they owe as much money now as when they did before, right?
Yeah. Well, this is something, if the Bears move to Arlington Heights, which, I think will happen, and, you know, maybe a nothing burger to the city in the long run. But if the fire build their park, you know, in the Area 78, like they're, you know, saying.
You're talking about the Bridgeview? Bridgeview had to raise taxes to pay for that.
Right.
They killed them. They buried that city on that park.
Right, right.
And
it could happen again too. But I think you're going to see a different kind of, you know, approach to, you know, events in the city, policing. Maybe it would be a good thing because Soldier Field has become kind of, you know, the end of the earth to get to and from for anything. They made it pretty uncomfortable. I think the Area 78 would be easier for people.
Well, they did it on purpose, yeah.
Yeah.
You walk out of there. There's no cabs, no whatever. Let me ask you this, just I know you have not spent your morning going through these numbers. When people talk about the Bears moving to Arlington Heights and how successful it's going to be, I'll just start with three basic questions. One is, can you name the last two stadiums that have been built for the NFL?
I can't. No.
Well, L.A. and New York. The new Meadowlands, when it's not a Meadowlands. What do they call it now, Jimmy? It's not the Meadowlands, but it's right by where the Meadowlands.
It's Giant Stadium. Yeah, and the other Life.
One?
I'm sorry.
What's the other one? SoFi out in L.A.?
SoFi in L.A.
All right, so what's unique to those stadiums?
Well,
the New York one isn't in New York, right?
No, they both have two teams in there, not one.
Ah.
Correct.
And they both cost $3.5-4 billion, I think. Jimmy, you might want to check me on that.
SoFi was close to five, but
all right. There are two teams in there, okay, instead of one. Now that should immediately cause the hair on the back of your neck to go up, because how is Arlington Park going to support one, which is one, that's going to cost probably $1 billion more because of the time, right? Now, what's the population that can get to SoFi versus can get to Arlington Park? What's the travel to get there? I mean, what are we talking about? 10 dates? Now, okay, we're going to have concerts. Well, we got all kinds of places for concerts. How many are we going to have a concert a day? Who's going to get there? I mean, to me, John, without putting even a pen to paper, I don't see how that dog flies or hunts. Do you?
No. I mean, they should have stuck with horse racing.
Well, yeah. I mean, for a long time, when the Meadowlands was built, Jimmy, didn't the horse racing pay for the nut on the stadium?
Yes, it did. My father happened to do the financing, and when they did, they realized the track really was the money. That was the cash flow right then and there for the bonds, was the horse racing track.
So they stole the money from the track and gave it to the football team, basically.
Well, they figured out that the track was the cash flow because, you know, this is in the mid, late 70s. And, you know, it was easy to get to. That was why it was moved to the Meadowlands. There was nothing there but the track.
Does the subway go there? You're a New York guy. Does the subway go there?
No. But it's easy to get to. The interstate does.
Okay.
It had lots of parking. As you know, before then, the Giants were playing in Yankee Stadium. The Jets were playing in Shea Stadium.
Yep.
And the problem with both of those, they're great to get to by the subway, but if you want to drive to it, they're nightmares. Well, Meadowlands was not a nightmare. You could get on and get to it from the George Washington Bridge, the Lincoln or Holland Tunnel, and go right onto the expressway and go right there. And it's in northern New Jersey. My father's firm at the time figured out how to pay for the bonds. Well, the racetrack was the answer. And at one point in time, they had the basketball and the ice hockey there, the stadium there for the teams, and the racetrack. So it turned out to be a very profitable, you know, piece of property, so to speak. And we do have Wayne and Andrew on the
right.
Phone.
John, thank you for helping out. But interesting
pleasure.
Stuff, huh? I mean, you know, but it's all the same, isn't it? The sports,
oh,
the
yeah.
politics, the companies.
I can segue to real estate on Monday if we got time.
But yeah, let's do that for sure.
Chicago's had it, so have a good weekend, guys.
All right, bud. Guys, Wayne, Andrew, how are you?
Good. Very good.
Well, putting Boyer to death with our economics lesson on sports teams and companies and all kinds of other stuff. And but it's kind of a question I would like to ask you guys. I know you're probably not ready for this, but I have a feeling you guys can answer just about anything. If I've been lately, I have a lot of clients that have these stocks to start with, but lately I'm getting a couple of newer clients that have some issues in some of the stocks that are the big seven, and the Microsofts, the Apples, the Nvidia. I mean, when we do the stuff for the Nigerian family office, I was doing the subcontracting there. The Nvidia and Apple were their biggest holdings, so it's not anything new. Okay, I mean, and a lot of people that have been investing for a long time. I mean, if you bought Apple cheap enough, it's been a life changing thing for a lot of people. Microsoft as well. I mean, if you bought Microsoft versus Cisco in 2000, you're way better off than Microsoft, aren't you? But my question is, the new variable seems to be, and I hope it isn't, but it seems to be government largesse, to lack of a better term. I mean, Google not getting really spanked with a huge fine on something where they were caught essentially dead nuts being a monopolist, right? They were convicted, but the fine was minimal or something. I mean, when I value these companies and I see them reaching this, get to go to the Oval Office and either drop a briefcase or do something to the president and come out with some sort of a favored company status, how should that enter my mental process? I mean, I sit there and go, boy, Nvidia and Microsoft look pretty high by historical standards, and I go, wait a minute, they seem to be the anointed ones. How do I put a value on that?
Well, it's very difficult. I don't envy you because you've hit on something that's pretty new. And what one is, are these companies going to be helped or hurt by a government action? And as part of that, they're all obviously quite big, so they're particularly vulnerable to antitrust regulation and that kind of interference, and they're so big that it's almost a new playbook, so it's hard to advise. You mentioned Google in that case. Well, that was decided a few blocks from me at the federal courthouse here in Washington, D.C. And the judge, Amit Mehta, is a pretty thoughtful guy. He's not a Trump appointee. But I think probably entering into his calculations and legal rationales is a simple thought: too big to fail. So maybe I'll leave it at that, but that's very hard to compute because you're working on data analysis and so forth, and some concept like too big to fail, how do you put crunch the numbers on that?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's you know, the $10 billion, I mean, the Sherman Act is what? Treble damages, and it's a felony, for God's sake, right? Or is it a felony? I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, it's both civil and criminal.
Yeah. Well, we're not going to see that again ever for one of these guys.
You know, I think unlike we've had, like, in the past, the president helping Chrysler in its time of need, but what's different between then and now is back with the Chrysler bailout, you didn't have the president demanding, I want some of the proceeds into my own pocket here. And I think you're seeing that more and more with this White House is, how does this benefit me? Not the country. And I think that's what's different. And I think that ushers in a feeling that we're into major crony capitalism, if not state corporatism, which is what you had in Mussolini's Italy and Pinochet's Chile.
Well, we talked about, I don't know if you guys had a chance to listen yesterday, but Russell and Dr. Ademiak, Professor Berto, we had a dual professor show yesterday, and the attitude, and you guys are not 25 anymore, the attitude is different, and actually the example we used, Wayne, was the Chrysler thing, and everybody knew that did you guys ever, by the way, if you're ever hanging around Fort Wayne, Indiana, which I can't imagine you would be.
Yeah, no, I've never had the, I've had my, Andy knows the story. I once ran for president of the National Press Club against somebody with one of the two Fort Wayne newspapers, which one of the things that surprised me was that Fort Wayne had two newspapers. This is like in 2008. But, no, I've never been there.
Well, there's a, if you're ever lurking around there, go to the Auburn Duesenberg Cord Museum in Auburn, Indiana. You two guys would spend 2 days there. Not looking at the cars, you could kind of do that in a few hours.
Yeah.
The history of the automotive industry, stuff you just never knew about. At one time, I think there was, according to the stuff, there was 26, 30 essentially car manufacturers in the state of Indiana. Indiana was the cradle of car stuff, not Detroit.
The hub.
Yeah, it was the hub. And we'd worked our way down to essentially three. There was, you know, they were the big three, but Studebaker had just gone out of business. American Motors had just gone out of business. Packard was gone, right? So we were down to the three. And all of a sudden Chrysler's in trouble and it was a recession and all that stuff. And they were looking for his loan. And Lee Iacocca got up the idea, why don't I get a loan from government? And he got more abuse going from congressman office to congressman office. You guys know this better. Finally, it was something that was absolutely appalling to America. But they did it because we didn't want to get down to two car manufacturers. We knew that was wrong too. So we give this guy the dough. He couldn't wait to pay it back. It was because everybody knew this was an outlier. This wasn't America. This was a one-time event brought upon by too much concentration in industry, and it was a one-time event. And people held their nose. They did it for a couple years. He paid everybody back, and it was over. The attitude now is so different. I mean, Dr. Ademiak was saying their students are, hey, what's the problem with government investing in some companies? The tone is so different that it's not even though Russell brought it up yesterday, as did you, Wayne, I'm going to say they're not even at all, do you? And what do you say, Andrew?
Well, I think you're right, although just as a footnote before addressing your main question, Iacocca ultimately became kind of a hero. He did go through abuse, but he figured it out in a way that became Mr. Fix-It. But and maybe that's part of the response to your question, that they did the unthinkable and it seemed to work out. I'm not sure how much students, I mean, with young people, I'm often very impressed with what they do and can do. And then other times I'm thinking there's just basic factual knowledge that's missing here.
Yeah, I would add to that this dawning of the era of the tech bro billionaires, a lot of younger people want to emulate them, and you know, we can talk about Musk and some of the others, but one of the more insidious people behind this tech bro sort of corporate statism is this guy named Curtis Yarvin, who's this guy out of Pennsylvania who's who's a big backer of crypto and whatnot. This guy wants to get rid of our present government and establish a techno monarchy. He thinks democracy is a foolish notion, and if you know this sort of, I mean, this guy Yarvin, in my opinion, is a nutcase, and I don't know what part of Pennsylvania he's from, but back when I was growing up in the Philly area, they used to send nuts like that to Byberry, which was the Philadelphia mental institution. But I just fear that these younger people are looking at people like Musk and Yarvin and thinking, or Peter Thiel is another one, and thinking, yeah, that's the way we should go. I like that. I like that idea.
Well, Harold Janine, you guys know the name.
Oh, yeah.
he was the head of ITT, which was, were they the world's first conglomerate? I think they were, weren't they?
Yeah.
And but he had there was a book written, The Sovereign State of ITT, and all they went through his thought process. I don't know if he was part, they interviewed him or what they did, but he thought, like a lot of young people today, he thought that the countries that were run by like democracies were so slow, cumbersome, that if guys like him just ran the world, everything would be way better, more efficient. And they would, and I think a lot of what is not maybe taught to people or explained to them or something is what sets us apart. And I know I'm preaching to the choir with you guys. What sets us apart is not that we don't make any mistakes, because we sure as hell do, right? What sets us apart is the process that if somebody's arrested, they get to plead their case, they get to face their accuser. That's what makes us different in the world. I mean, the other people were sitting there going, what are you paying this old clunky bailiff for? What are you paying this judge for? We all know he's guilty. Hang him. This is so inefficient. They have no idea that if we erased all that and had a court of public opinion, what the world would look like. But they seem to think that democracy...
Exactly. And it happens by coincidence. You brought it up. I haven't thought about this in decades. But... early in my career, I was a reporter for the Hartford Current newspaper, and a part of that merger, a critical part, came before the insurance commissioner of the state of Connecticut, just when I was starting out. And for a variety of coincidental reasons, I was studying that case, which illustrates exactly what you're talking about. And two quick things, just as a definitional matter. You said, wasn't that the first conglomerate? And I more or less agreed. And here would be the definition. There were bigger companies, Standard Oil, for example, General Motors, but I think ITT, as a historical note, was one of the first, maybe the first, to put totally different lines of business together with the thought, a conglomerate of many different kinds of business in the U.S. would be a great idea.
But he also was the first guy who wanted a world conglomerate, not just here.
Yeah, yeah. So, at any rate, this goes before the Connecticut insurance commissioner and the local federal judge, who for five years, I'd go into his chambers every year. And let me tell you a quick story about this judge. His name was Joseph Blumenfeld. And he had this meal ticket at this little municipal cafeteria across the street where you'd get like a 20% discount. And I've done feature stories on the guy. So here he is presiding over the biggest merger in the history of the U.S. to see if they could pick up Hartford Fire Insurance Company, and he's going with his clerks for lunch every day at this cafeteria where the most expensive meal is $2.10, and he pulls out his meal ticket. That's
God.
But ultimately, you know, they had very thoughtful hearings. He ultimately approved it, even though he was a big liberal, but they had to jump through a lot of hoops in the process that you're talking about. And the judge was just an incredible character who, a quick example of the type of guy he was, he had a repeat offender in a criminal case, and the attorney is saying, well, he had to burglarize something because he didn't have any money, and the judge says, well, I've listened to you, and I'm very sympathetic to his plight, you know, and I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to send him back to a nice place where he'll have all his meals taken care of. He won't have to pay rent, and he'll have free medical care. And the defendant jumps up and says, no, I don't want that.
What did Mike Tyson say? Three hats and a cot?
but at any rate, the process and the system that you're talking about, yeah, it used to work. And not to filibuster your audience here, but I'll just mention two other things. As part of the approval process in Washington, of course, ITT had the notorious lobbyist, Dita Beard, who was paying off the Republican Party with basically bribes through ITT to get their merger approved in Washington. But she was exposed by Jack Anderson, and it became a huge scandal when she admitted to Brit Hume, who's still on Fox News sometimes, Anderson's assistant, yes, that's my little D on the incriminating memo, she said.
Oh, God.
So yes, there were attempts at bribery. Sometimes they're caught. I know another person who worked there that was never caught, really. But there was a process. So I agree.
Well, what do you get? And maybe we'll get Wayne's opinion on this. Just something simple. This U.S. Steel thing, which they're now part of Nippon, right, in the government, or Trump. Trump seems to think he's the one with the votes, but whatever. Somebody's got 10% of the votes here. Now, they're one of, if you were just listening to the TV, or whatever you're listening to, your phone, you know, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. I mean, the firm's name is U.S. Steel. We got to do something for them. Forget the part where they haven't, you know, put up, I won't say a dime, but they've stayed open hearth furnaces for 50 years after everybody knew open hearth was going away, the dodo bird. I don't know what they do in terms of recyclables, because now a lot of stuff you see is all recycled. But now, I just happen to look here. Key U.S. steel companies. We got Nucor. They're the largest producer. We got Cleveland Cliffs, who I never put my clients in Cleveland Cliffs, but a lot of my clients have Cleveland Cliffs just for whatever reason. I think they're out of Cleveland, and we have a lot of clients from Ohio. There's Steel Dynamics, there's Commercial Metals Company, and there's Nippon Steel, and a couple of these guys really do a lot of work with the recycled stuff. And then there's ArcelorMittal. They're the guys that took over the big thing down in Indiana. So now what? If I go to build an aircraft carrier, do I have to buy the stuff from U.S. Steel? Or what do they gain by this? What does the government gain by this? Or is the pricing going to be more or less? Is it still going to be go out for bid? I mean, how does this all work together? I don't know. You tell me.
I think this points to Trump's, I hate to say it, worldview. I think his view doesn't extend beyond, you know, 3 inches. But he dreams of a past United States, which means he dreams of a past world. You know, yeah, why can't we go back? I think he's thinking about the early industrial age and into, you know, the time we had, you know, Henry Ford making automobiles, and you know, we were number one in a lot of industrial sectors. He's just a regressive individual, who doesn't like change. He wants to return to an era that the world will never return to.
Unless
he wants to turn us into North Korea and then just say, well, we're going to do our own thing and the rest of the world can,
Let me push back on this a little, on Wayne and Andrew can referee. I think you're a hair off on that in the sense of it's a regressive. It's actually a very, I won't say modern view, but it's a very European / German view of the world. I could say fascist, but I did spend a little time over in Germany lecturing. I was appalled. I couldn't wait to get out of there. The idea that every industry was 3 or 4 companies, banks owned a lot of the companies, banks had their nose up the ass of government, very, very controlled in that manner. Everybody was a piece of the government. Now, maybe not in terms of investment, but the power structure. That was the way they were before Hitler, during Hitler, after that's just their system. And I guess it works for them. They think it does. It makes entrepreneurship very difficult. It keeps young people not making any money for like a long period of time. I mean, God, you probably can't become a law firm partner until you're 80. That's a little harsh, but I mean, it's a system. I mean, Lou's the one who said it was a fascist system. Everybody's part of this group. Now, I don't know if Trump knows beans of what I just said, but his instincts are sort of the same way. I want to know that the government, has a line into the steel companies. Have a line. It's not like he thought it up. I mean, it's a very traditional German worldview, I would say. And I mean, Mussolini probably tried to do the same thing when he nationalized the railroads, right? Andrew, who's right here, Wayne or me? I don't think it's going back to our past. Our past was a lot different than that.
I'm not saying that you don't have. You're right about one thing. The EU is what? How many? 28 countries now.
Yeah.
And they all look. Which country do they look to as the financial, basic financial head of the European Union? Germany.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I remember when they switched to the euro, some of these countries I was over there, they had to turn in their own currency. And a lot of people said, yeah, I don't mind giving up the lira or the franc because basically we're going to be the euro is really going to be the Deutschmark. and they didn't say that in fear. They said that, look, hey, it's going to be stable.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But my point about Trump is that you look at it's his worldview, he thinks of I think he's thinking of the 1950s, and the world isn't that way anymore. This country isn't that way anymore, and the idea that he. Is he going to bring back Woolworths and Horn and Harditz? The automats and
you look at the whole. It's a way. If you look at, as you guys know, I'm in this business for pretty much my whole life. I think it's incredibly unique and very vibrant to have. If people want financing, we have a bond market. We have a stock market, and that's why the thing with Iacocca, because the market was in such horrible shape, you couldn't drag any money in because we had such an inflation thing, we'd all that stuff. He really had nowhere else to turn because the bond and stock markets were not working so well then. And then the government had another issue. Do we want to go in a 7-year period or 8-year period, maybe 10-year period, from 6 auto companies, or always was the big 3, to 2. So it was an antitrust issue, and they sort of collided at the same thing.
And he brought out the K car, didn't he keep the price down on that? Which was, this is my way of paying back the American taxpayers. I don't know how good they were. I didn't drive one.
my girlfriend at Allied Van Lines had a K car. They were, God, they were. I can't say.
Did you drive your K-car?
Well, it was the ugly. I wouldn't. I never rode it. It was the ugliest shade of blue I ever saw. But but the K-car. And then, well, then they bought Jeep, right? The Jeep saved them.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, there was a lot of things that came together at the time. But now, do we want to say forever now? The way you get money is to go kiss the president's ass, or are we going to use the stock market and bond market? I mean, that's a decision we have to make here. I know what I would like to see happen, but...
I think the fact is that we have a president who's, you know, he has an opinion on everything, and I think sometimes the president of any country or the prime minister of any country probably should not be talking about certain subjects. I mean, he and Trump is claiming credit for putting the cracker back in the Cracker Barrel logo. The old man sitting there by the barrel. I mean, he's got an opinion on everything, and my point is that you know, presidents should really think before they talk, because they can affect the market.
What did your girlfriend Erin Burnett say on CNBC to one day? I thought she's adorable. Well, still is. And then she goes, opinions are like bottoms. Everybody's got one, and they all stink. But, I mean, if the three of us, and we bring Jimmy with, because he's as opinionated as they get, and go to an adult beverage, and we're watching the Bears or Notre Dame or whoever it is, Cornell, we're going to see the quarterback try and throw on a down where he obviously should have run, and the four of us are going to go, this offensive coordinator is an idiot. That doesn't mean, if one of us is president, that the next day we issue an executive order to fire the offensive coordinator. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, there's a difference. We all can have an opinion. That's why we watch sports.
The bully pulpit, I think, comes with having some responsibility. I think now the bully pulpit is basically, what did Mao call the U.S., a paper tiger?
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Well, we're going to have to go to, we got to go to break here, but... we come back, a little bit of the theme here, and boy, I sure as hell hope I'm wrong. You guys talk me out of this, but in 8 months, it seems to me, and one of the guys was telling me this in the Tripoli the other night, he goes, we managed to have unify our enemies and splinter our friends. What are we doing? On that note, let's SP Futures up 7, NASDAQ Futures up 44. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. We've been talking about investing in the market for a long time now. I've tried to inject a sense of history into what the market has done and is capable of doing, both good and bad for investors. Recently, as in the past many years, the market, but not all stocks, have generally advanced and been made happy with a mostly passive, maybe self-directed strategy using electronic access someplace. I can tell you from experience, when something bad does happen, people reach for help. You know what? No one can really help you for probably a minimum of 2 weeks. How about something a little better? Why not do your online trading and investing here at PTI using the Interactive Broker online trading platform? It's a high-end system and is very competitive both in commissions and interest earned and charged. However, you gain two things. If you cannot access a system for whatever reason, outage, vacation, or have an issue with IB, we can help with a phone call. And if you get in trouble and need investment help, you can access me and our money management services right away. I really do not want to say to anyone, sorry, I can't help you. So call me at PTI Securities at 312-663-4310.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
And we're back.
Load up back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Jimmy on the board. For those who probably everybody knows, the jobs report tomorrow should be a real big one after last month's kind of clunky one, and see if the Fed has to move. We'll see if it's bad or it's good or whatever. We'll get Andrew and Wayne's view on that. Anyway, SP Futures up 10, NASDAQ Futures up 51. Not a whole lot going on. We've got the Salesforce down $15 of their earnings. They did not give a good prognostication going forward. Amazon's up 5. We got Tesla's up 3. So there's some movement here. Meta's up 11. The 7 stocks seem to have a big move yesterday. Apple was up like $9 yesterday. It's down $1 today, but keeping most of its 9. Over in Europe, DAX up 184.8%. FTSE up 20.2%. CAC RON's actually, call it flat, down 37 cents. That's because it is flat. Over in Asia, kind of a mixed bag here. We've got the Nikkei up 641, 1.5%. Hang Seng, however, is down 284, 1.1%. Shanghai down 47. These guys have been up pretty strong. Now, Shanghai's gone the other way the last couple of days. They're down 1.25%. So The Chinese situation still is something that, to me, is always kind of a fog. 10-year, 4.19. It's down 1 basis point. The Bund down 2 basis points, 2.71. Started out the week with the 30-year almost making it to 5, and now it's back down to 4.87. I wonder if the Fed saved the administration by going out and buying bonds, but maybe they did. Oil down 63 cents, 63.34. Brent down 67 cents, 66.93. Gold, which has been on a tear, is down 27 bucks today. It was down 30-something earlier, so it's coming back. Still over 3,600, 3,607. Boy, I never thought I'd see that. Silver down 46 cents, but still over 41. Again, never thought I'd see that. Foreign exchange, we have with a little change earlier. Same thing. Euro's at 116, the pound 134.3. And we've got Bitcoin down 1,200, 110.759. Jimmy, quick traffic weather sports.
Okay, well, on traffic, we have it, but we're having technical difficulties getting any actual times. In Chicago, it is right now approximately in the, it is 51 degrees with a high of 67. Phoenix at 74 and a high of 98. Now, they do have thunderstorms with possible flash flood warnings. In sports, Cubs did lose to the Braves 6-1. Diamondbacks beat the Rangers 2-0. The White Sox beat the Twins 4-3. And by the way, you know what did save Chrysler? Was the minivan.
Minivan, too.
The minivan was what saved him, and now no one has them anymore.
That's pretty amazing when you think about it.
Back to you, Chief.
So, guys, we went skiing 1 year, right when the minivan came out, right? So, the guy said, all we got is this minivan. The thing only had 5 miles on it. It was brand new. It was one of these extended ones, and I'm going, God, I don't want to drive one of these things. We put 6 people in there, all the skis, drove up and down the mountains, got like 20-some miles at a gallon. I'm going, this thing's going to be a huge seller. As much as you hated it, you could not love it. I mean, there was nothing wrong with the thing.
Why do you think it went out?
You know, I don't know. Well, now everybody's into the SUVs. Everybody has an SUV. Nobody gets a regular car, so they all have the 3 seats. I'm not sure, because that door was so much easier to get in if you have kids and stuff. Not sure about that. That's a good question. So what do you... Before a break, I was asking you guys, we have... Talk about a history. You know, the guys from... Even George Bush, senior and junior, that were from the World War II generation, when we were going to have some kind of a... There was a threat to us, or we were going to do something around the world, read Iraq, read all those kinds of things. There was always a big deal in putting together the coalition that everybody was in this. It wasn't just us. If you come against us, you're not coming against us. You're coming against virtually the whole world. So you better watch out. And now it seems like we've insulted the hell out of every one of our friends. At the same time, Russia, India, China, and North Korea to the extent, are ganging up essentially against us. At the same time, we're pissing off all our friends. What strategy is that? Or is it a strategy, or is it just happen? Did we just get there by accident, or what?
I looking at Trump's reaction to this, what it looked like, what the Xi Jinping hosted in China was like a convention for autocrats and dictators.
Yeah,
I mean, you had. I mean, Modi from India, he's not a Mr. Democracy either. He leads a pretty far-right government there. And, you know, India, yeah, they still have elections, but they're, you know, very much tainted. And he had a whole bunch of others, like Erdogan from Turkey. I think Trump was jealous that he didn't get the invite.
Yeah, it was like a rogues gallery over there.
Oh, absolutely. You know, like the old legion of villains, and you know, that used to take on Superman and Batman.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, why? And now at the same time, we can't wait to piss off our friends, saying they're not our. I mean, what are we doing here?
It's insane. The whole issue with. When Joe Biden left office, NATO was the strongest it had ever been. since its inception, because they added two new members, Finland and Sweden, which had been neutral for in some case over 100 years. Now you've got a situation where some of the countries in Eastern Europe are friendlier to Russia. They want to block support to Ukraine. And so, yeah, the situation is critical right now.
Can either one of you, I mean, both of you, out of the two of you, who can take us through a little bit, out of all the countries in the world that I kind of sort of keep my eye on, nothing like you guys, I always thought India was sort of a half-assed ally of some kind. What exactly has their history been with us? Are they allies? Are they enemies? Are they in the middle, or every man for himself? Or what's been the history there?
Let me leave that to Wayne, because he's written a lot about it.
Oh, I'm sorry. What country?
India.
India. Well, India during the Cold War was very friendly to the Soviet Union. Indira Gandhi started buying weapons from the Soviets. But in the early 60s, India and China had a border war, and President Kennedy basically supported India, including sending the CIA up into the Himalayas to put in monitoring equipment. And in some cases, they would use these Sherpas to climb these tall mountains, including Mount Everest, and install listening devices up there that, in one case, one of the listening devices was powered by a small nuclear generator, believe it or not. After Nehru died, he was the Indian prime minister, and his daughter took over, Indira Gandhi, India started taking a pretty pro-Soviet stance, was a leader in the non-aligned community. Under Narendra Modi, India, it's a Hindu nationalist government, very much opposed to the large number of Muslims that live there. India joined this group of nations called the Quad, which was India, Australia, Japan, and the United States, as a bulwark against increasing Chinese influence in the Pacific and Indian Ocean areas.
Where in this timeline is the Pakistan split off?
Well, Pakistan became independent when India became independent of Britain in 1947.
Okay, so this is all after that. Okay,
this is after that. Now when Indira Gandhi started to steer India towards the Soviets, of course, in Pakistan, they were basically considered an ally of the West, and we had intelligence gathering centers in Pakistan, which is ironic because there was even a U-2 base up in Peshawar, and during the whole issue with Osama bin Laden, Peshawar, Pakistan, was like a hotbed of Al-Qaeda. So it just shows you how things can change over a few years, where at one point in time you had CIA agents walking around in Peshawar because they worked at the U-2 base. And then, you know, a few years later, you got Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, walking around in the same place.
How did that happen?
It's the shifting sands of geopolitics, more than anything else. What is it? Henry Kissinger said, nations don't have friends. They only have interests.
Well, it's probably true.
Yeah, probably true, even though it's from...
So where would you put India now? A guy just trying to take what he can from both sides for his... I mean, is it a altruistic thing for India?
He actually believes India is one of the superpowers now. I think its population may be approaching that of China.
I think some people think it's already passed or will be soon.
Yeah, I think it has. So, you know, I think with Modi, it's the tariffs that Trump put on India, and I'm like, hey, if you're going to do that to us, we're going to find friends somewhere else. And even though India and China have been enemies for many years, and they were actually fighting a few months ago on their border, and also fighting Pakistan. As long as Trump is treating India as this economic enemy in the United States, I think you're going to see Modi continue to cozy up to both Putin and Xi Jinping.
What if when it comes to tariffs, and I certainly want to ask you about this upcoming Supreme Court thing, if we decide at Stocks and Jocks and you guys find us a place over in India, and we have, for whatever reason, we have 15 people taking calls from Stocks and Jocks over in India, and we send a, is that considered a purchase of service? Is there a tariff on that, or is that we just send a pay? I mean, how does that even work? What is that considered?
Andy might know that one because
Is tariffs just on goods, not on service?
I think I got to punt on that.
I think it probably is just on goods.
I think you're right. No, I think you're right, and I think isn't one of the situations with Trump now arguing about Europe is going to or they're taxing what they consider U.S. services, and he's going to retaliate on their services. I mean, what is, you know, is this going to be like an internet tax? Internet tariff? Is that what we're talking about?
What if,
who knows?
What if the Supreme Court shuts them down? There was a thing, I don't know if I told you guys, on one of the Sunday TV shows. It was one of the national, Face the Nation or the other, but I was listening on the radio, so I couldn't tell which one it was. And they had one of Trump's flunkies on there, and the lady says, well, what defines an emergency? And the guy goes, anything the president says is an emergency is an emergency. Well, if you play that, which you won't in front of the Supreme Court, I don't see how the Supreme Court says any of this stuff's an emergency. I mean, how does the 50% tariff on Brazil, because he doesn't like the prosecution of his buddy, how is that an emergency?
Yeah, I think this is, it's like with anything. He thinks there's an insurrection in Chicago. So he wants to send troops in? I mean, we're... Yeah, I know. We all know you more than anybody else know about the situation here, and the shootings and whatnot. But is it in fact what the founding fathers considered to be an insurrection, and people that came into office after them? I think they were thinking of insurrections as sort of what the Confederacy did in 1860.
Well, this is one of those things, and you guys know I'm pretty much. When you're in the middle, you actually get to listen to both sides. If you're on one side or the other, you only listen to your side, right? and what do you guys say? It's like trying to learn something in an echo chamber. You know, you can't really do that. I don't know which one of you guys said that, but it was a great line. Regarding the Chicago situation, I think in some regards, they're kind of both right. The shootings and murders are down 25% from last year. Okay, they're still high. People are still afraid. Last weekend, there was a 7-person shooting, which in any other city would, or in any other country in the world, would be worldwide news, right? And we had a 7 and a 4 last weekend. So the idea from the mayor that everything's okay, we got it under control, is a load of horseshit. Now, Trump wanted to put troops here, untrained National Guard. One of my good buddies last night, I had an adult beverage with. He was part of the National Guard back in the Vietnam era and was called out for the Democratic National Convention.
Oh, yeah.
And he is absolutely adamant, saying there is no law enforcement training. You can't have them pull over somebody in a car. They don't know how to write a ticket. If you want to if you want to do give them a year's police training, maybe, but you can't just throw those people out on the street and expect them to be policemen. They're not. Now, if you came in with something rational, which is, I think, impossible for Trump and maybe the mayor, if you came in and said, look, your city's broke. One of the reasons why you're broke is you're letting people retire at age 52 or 55 and paying them right away. What's the matter with you? If somebody wants to come off the street, what I'm going to offer you is courses from the FBI in forensics, in scene investigation, all the latest we have that you can take the people that are now coming off the street. We can retrain them for the next 10 years. We can actually solve some crimes here, which we don't very much. 85% of the murders, we don't even have a person of interest. So to say there's no problem is idiotic. So now, is there a way for the federal people to help out the local people to get more people on the street because we're 2,000 officers short? Is there a way to do that if the two people could actually talk to each other?
Well, what I heard Pritzker saying was, we have a gun problem in Chicago. And the guns are coming in from, like, Indiana. So maybe Trump should put federal agents on the state line down in South Chicago coming into the city and check everybody's trunk coming in, and then hit the people down in Southern Illinois that are driving those weapons up from, what I think you said, Mississippi and Louisiana, where they can buy as many guns as they want. Start checking trunks of cars. Let's see how long the NRA remains silent about that.
Pritzker is another one of these guys. If you unfortunately or fortunately, you don't have to, but I drive the expressways a lot here. I have clients I go see. Audrey lives in New Orleans. And the governor, with his bare face out there telling you there's no problem, he has one car assigned to any expressway at any given time, from what I understand. You never see anybody. If you come down to Ryan on a Sunday night or Saturday night, if you don't have 15 idiots going by you at 100 miles an hour with blacked out windows, I mean, and there's no attempt to stop any of that. And yet the citizens sit there and go, I'm by myself. I mean, there's nobody helping me here. There's no, God help you if you get caught on the side of the road. There's none of that. Now, who makes these decisions? And for Pritzker to say everything is fine, it's not fine, Gov. So, I mean, I guess I'm in the middle, and I don't want federal troops anywhere. You guys know that. I think the National Guard is not the person to help out. But the city and the state, there's reasons people are leaving here. There's reasons seven people got shot Saturday night in one spot. To say that, don't worry, we're down from 1,000 shootings to 800, everything's okay, that's pretty ignorant in my mind. I mean, what do you guys, I'm talking too much, what do you guys think?
Well, here's, they have programs, and one of the main programs, which I'm familiar with because I had a close relative who worked on it for a couple of years, is law enforcement grants through the Justice Department to help local law enforcement. Now, there's always going to be some excessive spending and something like that, but I can say from close firsthand observation that the concept is to have police who are part of the community, who are not looked on as invaders with masks and guns, but that somebody could say, hey, look, there's a crack house on the next block, and there's all kinds of hookers. Can you do something about it? And to have what we aspire to as law enforcement of people who are not looked on as enemies of the community, but people who are helping solve problems, maybe before they happen, but certainly afterwards. Now, there's always going to be the crack house people who go nuts over a bad deal or whatever, and have all kinds of shootings and at the nightclub and this and that. But the concept that sending in untrained guardsmen with guns is going to solve it, that's political, because it can't logically solve the problem. And in fact, those of the listeners with longer years and memories, let's remember what happened in the late 60s when huge parts of the cities went up in flames. Because,
and still haven't recovered, by the way.
Yeah. And that, here in Washington, it happened, and all through major areas. And so, in the very short run, political partisans who like this kind of let's send in the National Guard and military, they can point to a temporary reduction in crime and say, see, it's working. But here are the costs of that. The bill hasn't come in for, you know, these guardsmen losing work and having to be paid and having to be put up in hotels. So just in budget terms, you haven't seen the results. It's total short-term thinking. There's going to be a bill, money, that's got to be paid. But the other thing is, you have an incident, and we have here in Washington, Wayne follows it pretty closely on YouTube, of just massive protests of people in these communities yelling at the National Guard and to get out of here, ICE, get out. And suppose, well, it's not imaginary, but it's not an if, it's when some of the young people from Mississippi or West Virginia that are coming into places like Washington get frightened or angry and unleash their weapons on the protesters. Yeah, some people are going to like that because that'll prove that there is an emergency. But when the arsons start and whole neighborhoods go up in flames, is that really what we want?
You know, I'm absolutely with you, and it's always hard to argue with somebody you agree with. But on the other hand, Andrew, I don't know what the answer is. I know for sure what Trump's doing is not the answer. So on that, we, I think, are on the same, not only the same page, but on the same line. But the idea that for years and years, regular people live in these neighborhoods and don't appear to have any rights whatsoever, like their daughter walking down the block without a bullet flying over her head, and for people to say, well, that's just our culture, oh, by the way, it's a little better than last year, that's not right either.
Well, Tom, you know, and the situation with the, people getting shot, it still exists in Washington, even with all these guardsmen in town, because the guard is not being sent into the neighborhoods, especially at night, where these incidents take place. The violence prone neighborhood in Washington is basically in Northeast Washington, D.C., bleeding a little bit over into the Maryland suburbs. And you don't see any National Guard there. And I actually resent a photo of, there were like five National Guardsmen in downtown D.C., a place called DuPont Circle. Looked like they were guarding the Krispy Kreme donut place.
Really?
Well, you know, maybe that is a strategic target, but or maybe they were just protecting the cops that were in there. Anyway, the issue is, the guard is down in the, on the mall where the Smithsonian, and they're there where all the monuments are. The guard is only there for public relations. The guard is not being sent to where it ostensibly could be used, although they are not trained in law enforcement, But they're definitely not found in these dangerous places.
I'm with you 100%. My question, I guess, is let's pick one spot that I'm familiar with. Let's say the Dan Ryan on Saturday night or on Sunday night or Saturday or whatever. On one of these nights, or maybe two in a row, there needs to be 40 state police cars because it's their spot. Anybody over 100 with the blacked out windows gets searched. There's a gun in the car. The car is impounded. And if we impound 400 cars in the first three nights and I don't have to deal with them next week, I don't want it to be the guard. I don't want it to be the army. Somebody's decided, let it all go. It's all okay. I don't like that decision either. I mean, it's kind of where I'm coming from on this. I mean, you're right. It shouldn't be Trump. It shouldn't be the guard. It shouldn't be the army. But it needs to be somebody, and it's nobody. How do we deal with that?
Well, you're right, and it's not just there. I know a situation like that where a friend of mine lived in the D.C. suburbs, and they'd have drag races right outside her house, and she'd and she was kind of an activist. Nobody will do anything.
No.
And here's what they'd say. Well, their cars go too fast. We can't catch up with them.
Yeah.
And that can't be the answer. You're totally right. It's too dangerous to chase the 100-mile-an-hour people, so let them do what they want. What's needed is pressure, just like what you're saying.
Well, I'll give you a real crazy little example. By the way, did you guys see the list of the 68 jobs that that they can take off? They can take off their tip stuff. Anyway, I drive in a few weeks ago, and there's a church behind my house, right? And there's like a little school. I drive in and I go, that wasn't there. There's a big thing of graffiti on the side of the school. So we happen to have a tape thing, a security camera in the alley. Sure enough, I get these two young people. They're two white kids. And it's so bizarre. They do it. I don't know if they knew it was a camera. They essentially look right into the camera and take a selfie of themselves with them and the graffiti they just put on the wall. Somebody's got to know who these kids are. So I call up the alderman. Right? First I call the police. I said, I got this tape. Do you guys want any of this? Oh, yeah, we don't want it. Maybe we'll talk about it at the next community or the community meeting. I said, so you're not, no effort at all to see if anybody recognizes any one of these kids or anything like that. Nah. So I called up the alderman, and the lady was concerned about was what kind of wall was it so they could bring out some other kind of paint to go over it so it didn't look like graffiti. I said, do you want the tape? Nah, we don't want the tape. they're only 16, but what are we teaching people? I mean, what are we doing here? I don't get it.
Well, you're right. I mean, this drag racing is going on all over the country. Good friends of mine, their son was drag racing through a neighborhood and wound up killing himself. The police did try to chase him, but he ran off the road and into a lamppost or something. But this is going on. I hate to sound like the line from Bye-bye Birdie, but what's the matter with kids today?
Yeah.
There's something wrong with them.
So,
well, the graffiti, drag racing, these are the words of the powerless. And what's needed is a solution to channel people more into feeling less powerless and into more constructive activities. I mean, one thing that I'm noticing, because I spent a lot of time at YMCAs as a kid and so forth, but a lot of them are closing down, including in Hartford, where I used to work, and here in Washington. And maybe that's obviously not the answer right now, but what's taking its place? And and that's a concern.
Andrew, we only got a second. I can always talk to you guys forever, but someplace, somewhere, I'm totally with you on this, but at some point, I don't have a family, but I have nephews and nieces that I care about a lot. I don't give a crap whether you didn't get three lunches, hot lunches, when you were 5 years old or your daddy didn't like you. You're not driving 110 miles an hour next to my niece. That ain't happening. I mean, somewhere along the line, there are absolutes, I think. And I don't know, if you want me to feed you lunch, I'll feed you lunch. But don't be putting my people in danger. I mean, there's a middle ground there. And I know where you're coming from. And by the way, I'm coming from kind of the same place. But, you know, I don't know what the solution is, but there's certain things you just can't do. You can't shoot a car out at a window and not care who you hit. I don't care if your daddy didn't love you at that point, right? Really? I mean, am I being too harsh here today or not? I mean, I'm not.
No, put him in jail. I agree.
Anyway, but, guys, what do you got going this weekend? Anything good?
I'm just going to try to stay out of the heat down here.
I'm reading this list, and I'm not so sure you're a guy that does this, but, you know, exotic dancers, their tips are tax deductible.
Yeah, we have more than one of those places in the Tampa area.
And Andrew, I know you are a guy that does this stuff. A self-enrichment teacher. I don't know I guess you can call one of your lectures self-enrichment. I don't know what the hell that means, but you get to deduct your tips too. So
I'll look into it.
So next time, instead of them paying you $100,000 for your appearance, tell them to pay you $50,000, and everybody there, the 50 people, drop $100,000 in cash. You don't have to declare that.
There you go.
See the little things here: tour guides, recreational pilots, golf caddies. There you go, tailors.
Well, having just spent 4 hours yesterday at the Epstein coming out rally for victims. There's a different message conveyed yesterday.
Well, if you go to one of these things and don't want to be recognized, and you go to a makeup artist, the tip you give them, they don't have to pay taxes on it.
So the person applying the orange makeup on Trump?
Yeah, doesn't have to.
I hope he's tipping them.
Well, yeah. I mean, my guy who comes... you know, if I pay him $20 to do my snow, he's supposed to pay. Well, he has to pay what, 15% to the government of that, right? But if I pay him $1 and 19 of it's a tip, then he's okay.
There you go.
Do you have to pay Medicare and self-employment tax on tips?
Unemployment.
God. Anyway, guys, is there ever not enough to talk about, for God's sake?
Never.
You guys are the best. Andrew, take care. Next week, tell us about the thing you went yesterday. That would have been interesting. We'll talk about that next week. S&P Futures up 6 only now. NASDAQ Futures up 27. Thank you, Jimmy. Back tomorrow. Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.